From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Deucing in Dallas, Texas. And joining me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado is John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And on Skid Row in L.A., joining us from the Cecil Hotel, we have Eric Zaldivar. Say hello, Eric.
Hello.
And today we are talking about a Marvel movie. We are talking about Stick, which is a prequel to Daredevil. It's a movie about Daredevil's mentor, Stick, from the Frank Miller mythos. Very excited, very exciting to talk about that. I don't know. That's what I always thought of when we talk about Stick. It's actually not a Marvel movie. We're talking about Stick, directed by and starring Burt Reynolds, 1985. Also starring George Segal, Charles Durning, Candice Bergen. Eric, this is one you suggested, although John's talked about it a lot too. What made you want to do Stick?
Well, I think I said Sharky's Machine first, and then for whatever reason, that was X-Nade. And then I said, well, Stick's free on YouTube. That's how that went down.
Why did Sharky's Machine get X-Nade? Was that because Stu wanted to do it, or I don't know. That's one I feel
we
like.
We were gonna do it one time. Stu backed us out of it, like, the day of recording or something, or maybe the day before.
Yeah.
And then I got rid of my DVD years ago, because I watched it. I said, I'm probably not going to watch this again unless there's a Blu-ray or something, you know, because it had problems with it. Then I read the novel, and which is drastically different, and then really wished I had held on to that Snapcase DVD, because I don't know if it ever got a Blu-ray release. I think when Mark Wahlberg's remake was announced, I figured there'd be a Blu-ray, but the Wahlberg movie was never made.
Yeah, I remember that was something that was talked about for a while, but it never happened.
Yeah, I think it was one of those things pitched, and then for whatever reason, they were like, nah.
Nah.
There is, in fact, a Blu-ray.
There is. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've read that same novel, and it's the movie is actually better than the novel.
Yes, it is. It totally is.
Yeah, I remember us trying to do Sharky's Machine, and it's one of the episodes that never happened that I feel like we've attempted to do a few times.
Right.
But and that one was also directed by Burt.
Yes.
Burt, you know, not really thought of as a director the way his contemporary Clint Eastwood is. You know, he never really, I feel like he never really got that directing career.
He was really pushing for it around this time when he made Stick. Really, really pushing for it.
Well, yeah, he was also directing kind of quietly TV episodes of Amazing Stories and a few other things at the time.
Yeah.
Schwarzenegger tried doing that too. He was directing like TV stuff, you know, but never got caught.
I don't know. I think that happened later, wasn't it? Because I know he directed an episode of Tales from the Crypt. So that's like 89, 90.
It was like 90. Because he remade Christmas in Connecticut on TV with Tony Curtis.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, in the 90s. It was in the 90s that Schwarzenegger was trying that out, trying his hand at directing. Yeah, Tony, go over here, and you're going to burn the turkey. It's going to be funny.
That's hilarious.
It's hilarious.
It's really funny.
It's funny.
It's going to be very funny.
Imagine his DVD commentary.
My father, I burnt the turkey one time, and he beat me. And it reminded me of Trump.
he made me do squats.
Arnold.
Burt directed a lot of episodes of Evening Shade. He did 36 episodes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And he directed a TV movie called The Man from Left Field, which he starred in. I never saw. It must have been one of those Turner things or something. Like when TNT was doing those movies. It was filmed on Burt Reynolds' Florida estate. Now I got to see it. Let's see. Yeah, he had 15 directing credits. And then there's three episodes of BL Striker. Did an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. That's right. Okay. I was trying to remember where that was. This was the 1985 revival. And
it's called Method Actor. So was he doing his Marlon Brando impression again, like he did on
the one that apparently Brando hated him ever since he did it on the Twilight Zone?
Twilight Zone, he's like, what's my motivation?
Yeah. It's pretty good. It's the highlight of that episode, which was it was when it was in an hour long story format, and it was basically too long. It didn't really work.
That I always forget that Burt directed Gator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did. Pacing.
A movie that, even though that the show that they idolize it in has kind of been forgotten about, Archer.
Archer, yeah.
I couldn't get away from Archer like 5 years ago, but now nobody talks about Archer, and yeah, they make it seem like Gator is the be all end all.
Yeah, no, there. I've known a few Zoomers who are really into Burt Reynolds because of that show.
Well,
oh, really? That's happened? Oh.
Yeah, no, they're like, ah, Burt Reynolds, Smokey and the Bandit, Gator.
Is it to laugh at him?
I think it's a little bit of, it kind of starts at that, but then they actually go, wait, he's actually cool.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because it's hard to not love Burt, you know?
Burt's hard not to like.
Yeah.
He does have that charisma to get you to an awful film, you know, because he's like, you want to see him do something cool.
Well, he's like Clint in that way.
Yeah.
Well, they were both, there's that famous story that they were both told by some acting teacher, like when they were together, that they would never be good actors or never be in movies or so. Have you heard that story?
The story goes that they were fired off whatever lot it was, and they were both told, they point to Clint and they say, hey, you're Adam's apple. Well, they say that you know, they're terrible and they're firing you, and they ask why. And they go to Clint and they say, because your Adam's apple's too big. And then Bert says, well, what about me? And they turn to him and they say, you can't act. And then the big punchline of that story is, as they're walking out of the studio, Bert turns to Clint and says, you know, you're going to have a hell of a time getting rid of that Adam's apple, but at least at some point I can learn to act.
But they both, one thing I wanted to talk about was kind of the similarities and differences between Bert and Clint, because they kind of go together in my head. Maybe it's because of that story. Maybe it's because they were in City Heat together. But they kind of have,
and they were real life buddies too. Yeah. They were real life good friends.
And they kind of had some similarities in their career trajectory, but then very vast differences.
Yeah.
And one thing I wanted to talk about was Stick is a tough guy movie. This feels like the sort of movie Mike Malloy would cover, you know?
Right.
But I feel like Bert has had different. I don't know if phases is the right word, but there are different Bert modes. Like, you have Bert,
yes.
Bert, the kind of middle America redneck comedy guy, like Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah.
You've got Bert, the prestige actor with Deliverance, maybe Nickelodeon, Boogie Nights. And then there's Bert, the like tough guy, like Stick. Is Gator a comedy? Is it a tough guy movie?
I mean, that stuff straddles the line. There's what about the prequel to Gator? That's a tough guy movie. White Lightning.
White Lightning. Also,
but if we're talking later in the game, we're talking Malone. We're talking Heat. You know,
Malone's the one I was trying to think of. Heat is another one. And then there's Bert, the guy who doesn't care and is cashing checks. You know.
That's Uwabowl, Bert.
Yeah, that's Bert.
In the Name of the King.
In the Name of the King and Dukes of Hazzard, and oh, just so many movies no one's seen. Delgo? Did anybody see Delgo?
No.
that was a movie that famously made like 5 cents, you know? What do you see Bert Reynolds as, John? Are those phases accurate, or are there some I'm missing?
I think there's that's probably the best way to sum it up. I found out recently he did a lot of stuff in the 90s I've never seen.
Yeah.
He did a lot of stuff in Double O's I've never seen. He was working. Yeah. I think Bert was in Don't Want to Sell the Florida Property to Pay Off My Debts mode, because it was just like, you know, that was like post-divorce bad investment Bert. And he did a ton of stuff. He even did a horror film called The Maddening. And then he lots of TV movies and psychological thrillers. And I mean, he'd just show up for the check, I guess. Or
The Maddening was available on Prime as of 2 weeks ago. I tried to watch it.
You tried?
I didn't even get to Bert, to be honest. The whole thing just so it just seemed so beneath me at the moment. I was just like, let me just watch something else.
It's kind of sad because I do find myself watching stuff. Like, I watched one that was like, I don't know what the hell the title was, but it was almost like a PM Entertainment action film where he's Bert looks like he took some steroid shots and he's doing like a big Stallone type of action movie in the 90s when he's way past his prime. Oh, yeah, yeah, it was Raven. That's what it was.
Raven, it's terrible. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, oh, man, was it bad.
Do you know what the first movie I saw Burt Reynolds in was?
It's the same one I saw.
Cop and a Half?
Yeah.
Yeah! Yeah, buddy! Directed
yeah,
by...
my mother took me to the cinema in 93?
Yeah, 93, yeah.
Yeah, didn't know who Burt Reynolds was, didn't know the history, didn't know anything. Just went to go see Cop and a Half, and then I forgot about it.
You know who directed that movie?
Fonzie.
Fonzie, Henry Winkler, yeah. That was one of those Home Alone ripoffs, you know?
Yeah, smart alecky kid gets in bad with some crooks, you know? It was also shot where this was mostly shot, even though they claim it's Miami. Most of it is Fort Lauderdale.
Interesting. Yeah.
Bert, okay.
Oh, wait a second. I might be wrong on that. Maybe Cop and a Half was shot in Tampa. Sorry.
Bert loved to shoot in Florida.
Yeah.
Like, everything. He is Florida man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he could go home at night. He could go home and see Lonnie, you know?
Well, honestly, I mean, like, Miami, South Florida in general is kind of underutilized in cinema, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's an interesting place. Like, culturally, it's really like you got Gators, you got the Everglades, you got, the pastel kind of colors, especially at that time. It could make a pretty, you know, kick-ass crime movie. They've done it before. Miami, and what have you.
And at the time when they made Stick, it had not been used that much. Like, I know Scarface had not been out when they were filming this. And, it was like that. It was kind of a new place to film movies. You know, only Superfuzz had been filmed there, I think, and
The Italians,
Crime Busters,
and most, if not all, of those extra large movies.
Yes, that's true, which were never seen over here.
But I think one of the biggest tragedies of Bert's career is that there was no intersection for Bert to star in a live-action adaptation of Mike Barron's Florida Man. Because he could have been. Florida Man is Burt Reynolds.
It was 30 years too late, but Mike would want Antoine Fuqua to direct it because that's like his favorite director, so it didn't work. Yeah.
Oh boy.
I get into a lot of instant messaging.
Is it because of Training Day?
I guess. I don't know. No, he liked that boxing movie, Southpaw.
Southpaw.
Yeah, I never watched it simply because it's directed by Antoine Fuqua. I don't watch that guy's movies.
What was your memory of Cop and a Half?
I remember liking it just fine when I was a kid. I remember Burt Reynolds says, "I carry a bazooka" at one point, and I was thinking, when's he going to get the bazooka out? And so I was hugely disappointed that Burt Reynolds didn't shoot a bazooka. No, I remember thinking it was a fun, like, kid getting into hijinks. And I thought Burt was cool, you know, even though he's debasing himself in the movie. But when you're a little kid, you don't care, you know.
No.
But... but yeah, that was my first memory of Burt Reynolds was Cop and a Half.
Well, years later when I got into Burt, I was kind of surprised that it was actually him, you know, because I didn't know who he was at the time.
I did. I don't know why I noticed him. Maybe I thought he was cool and that's why I knew who he was. But I think when I was a kid, I would get him confused with Tom Selleck because they both had the mustache. So that's possible.
When Bert died, I don't know if it's a fake tweet or what. When Bert died, Tom Selleck tweeted, "Please stop. I'm not dead. Please stop sending messages."
You know, Bert. Gosh, he did. There's so much I forgot about that he's done. He was in that episode of The X-Files where he played himself, basically.
Yeah, I watched that recently.
Yeah, John and I are going to do an episode on that one at some point. You can join us, Eric.
Of course.
I didn't want it to seem like I was excluding you.
You can't be on our X-Files show, Eric.
Eric, yeah, John and I are going to talk about it, but you're not invited.
You're not part of the X-Files club.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry, you're like Agent Doggett. We don't like you.
I'll be the dissenting opinion on that show if you want.
You know what Bert was in that I totally forgot about, Eric? Grand Theft Auto Vice City.
Oh yeah, he's
Avery Carrington.
he's the porn producer. No,
that
he's
was Dennis
the cowboy half real estate guy.
Yeah, Dennis Hopper played the porn producer.
Right.
A lot of it's names.
Did a video game. Oh no.
No. John, this game had a stacked cast. It had Ray Liotta, William Fichtner, Tom Sizemore, Dennis Hopper, Burt Reynolds, Luis Guzman, Robert Davi, Danny Trejo, Gary Busey, Lee Majors, Ferruccia Balk, Danny Dyer, Kevin McKidd, and Debbie Harry.
Was David Carradine already dead?
No,
it wasn't.
No, he was not.
It's probably the best cast of that entire series.
I think it's the best cast of any video game ever, to be honest.
Yeah, you're probably right.
It is astonishing. I'm a little amazed.
Well, because then they did Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, and that had a pretty stacked cast too, but not as stacked as that. It had like Samuel L. Jackson and Chris Penn, but, you know.
James Woods too.
That's right. I forgot James Woods was in it. But then I think video games, you know, that was when they kind of flirted with getting big Hollywood casts. But then I think maybe wisely pivoted to just good voice actors, because, you know, Red Dead Redemption 2 does not have any big names in it. Like, I would be playing it and going, is that Brad Dourif? No, it's not Brad Dourif. You know, but yeah, I think that was kind of an attempt to go super prestige with a cast in their game. But yeah, Bert was in that was Bert. That's Bert's video game credit. But so Stick is a tough guy movie. Bert plays Ernest.
May I interject for one second?
Yeah. Go for it.
Ross Hagen plays Landon Ricketts in Red Dead Redemption.
Who's Ross Hagen? I don't know that name.
It's a guy that people like only Mike Malloy would appreciate. He's this like very low tier tough guy actor from the 70s.
He did some Fred Olen Ray movies, I think.
Yeah.
I think Mike would probably get along with the people who make creative decisions at Rockstar in that regard. He needs to be working for them in some capacity, you know. But they're too busy.
It was the last thing he did before he died, according to IMDb.
Really?
Yeah.
This is the first Red Dead Redemption.
This is there's Revolver, but
oh,
yeah,
Red
the
Dead
first,
Revolver, yeah.
Yeah, from 2010.
Okay, yeah. Red Dead Redemption, yeah. Red Dead's cool. Anyway, so
sorry.
Go ahead. It's all good. No, I'm glad you pointed that out. So Stick is a movie where Bert plays Ernest Stick Stickley. He's fresh out of prison. He's not called Stick because he has AIDS. Okay.
I didn't even think of that.
I remember when John first mentioned this movie, I was like, was this during the Bert AIDS scare?
Well, yeah, it was smack dab in the middle of it. And we can't really even talk about Stick without talking about what happened on City Heat, really.
Okay, yeah. Let's talk about that. Okay. Let's talk about what happened to Bert on City Heat.
Yeah. The reason why that is because it has to explain Reynolds's look in Stick, which seems to fluctuate throughout the entire movie. But go ahead, yeah. John.
He got hit during a fight scene for City Heat, which was already a troubled production. Bert got hit by a real chair instead of a prop chair. I don't know how these screw-ups happen. And he had, like, an injury to his jaw and could not eat. And it's weird when you think about it. He's going to the best doctors probably in the world. He can see the best surgeons in the world, and he cannot, they can't solve his issue. And apparently, because of this jaw injury, he lost a ton of weight because he had to be on a liquid diet. He couldn't chew food or basically just eat solid food. So he lost something like 30 to 40 pounds. And so he was one of those guys who was always in the tabloids. So there were these photos of him out in public looking extremely thin. So then the rumor was getting around because he had a lot of gay friends in the industry, like Charles Nelson Reilly and possibly Dom DeLuise. That's never on record. That Bert had AIDS. And Joan Rivers on The Tonight Show, she would sub for Johnny all summer long. So nightly it was the Bert has AIDS jokes, and it just kind of stuck. And then Sally Field, was interviewed by Playboy, and they asked her straight up, does Bert have AIDS? And she says, I wouldn't know. So she didn't help him at all.
Well,
it was even worse than that. She was quoted as saying that, but also followed it up with, there's something always around Bert. I don't know what it is, like implying that it's possible.
What a nice ex-girlfriend.
But, yeah. Yeah, he goes into his problem in great detail, and his he devotes a chapter to it in his first autobiography, My Life, which I was looking, I had read before, and I quickly was kind of looking through it to see if there was any Stick stuff, but he does not talk about Stick in that book at all. He does discuss it in his latest autobiography before he died, but how he described his jaw issue is horrifying. He was constantly nauseous for like a whole year. He couldn't eat, as you said. It seems like a nightmare. He described it as being constantly seasick.
Yeah, he was like always in pain. I think he got addicted to painkillers as well.
Yeah,
like so it's almost he's the first victim of the opioid epidemic, but survived for a few more decades.
And that's why he looks deathly in Stick.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks really skinny in this movie.
He sounds bad, too. Like, his voice is very...
He sounds bad, and his weight seems to fluctuate, and that's because of the reshoots, but I guess we can get into that later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in Stick, Bert plays this guy who's fresh out of prison, and he meets with his buddy, who's in Miami. They're in Miami. His buddy, Jose, played by Jose Perez Rainey. He gets him in on some like crime gig that goes south really fast. The guy they're working for is a dude named Chucky, played by Charles Durning, Papio Daniel himself. And he has this albino henchman who's amazing. I love this guy. he's got these droopy dog eyes. Like where his eyebrow seems to just sink over his eyes, which are, you know, red and pale. They're really creepy. Like, he's played by Dar Robinson.
Stuntman legend.
Yeah, just super scary, creepy dude. Like, just plays it to the hilt. It's great. Rainey gets killed. Stick has to escape. And he decides to embed himself with a rich, loudmouth, goofy guy played by George Segal. And... he becomes his driver. This guy's associated with Chucky, and this kind of gives him some cover while he's able to sort of plot his revenge. It's based on a novel by Elmore Leonard. Have any of you read the book?
I have, yeah.
Years ago.
How is it?
I don't think Elmore Leonard was writing good stuff in the 80s. I think I've said this on another show. The best stuff I've read from him is his early westerns, mostly.
What do you think of Leonard overall? Like, what's your opinion of him, Eric, as a writer?
I'm sure that it seemed hip at the time, and I'm sure that's why he had a following, but everything that I've read from him, crime-wise, at least in the 80s, I've read 52 Pickup, which actually it's the same as the film, and Stick is reads just like the film. So that's why I find it a little weird that Leonard ended up not liking the movie. I think what they have on screen is the book, pretty much. Sometimes, you know, books just work as books, and you can translate it to the hilt and on a screen, and it may not do anything for you. Whereas it actually might be a pretty good book. Like, I feel that way about Bert's next movie, Heat. The book is great, and the movie is exactly like the book, but not as good as the book. There's something to do with the theater of the mind, not comparing to what they ended up doing on screen, I guess. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Difficult to pin down.
And another troubled production that Bert wouldn't talk about in his autobiography, I think, because of the various lawsuits. William Goldman wouldn't even talk about Heat because
well,
of the lawsuits
is,
involved.
Yeah, he goes into it in detail in his original autobiography and then leaves it out in the newest one. So it's the exact opposite of Stick. Stick he talks about in the newest one and then doesn't talk about it at all. He doesn't even bring it up.
Yeah.
Do you think it's because he already talked about it or his feelings changed? Because I remember Sammy Hagar said when he wrote his autobiography, he was pissed at the Van Halen brothers and he wanted blood. And so like he was super negative towards them. And he goes, people have been wanting me to do an audiobook. He goes, but, you know, I'm not in that same place emotionally. And he goes, if I do an audiobook, I'm going to want to take out stuff where I'm super mean to them because I've since cooled on that. You know, we're on better terms now. Like he said, if he was to go back and do that, it would be completely different. Like if he did an audiobook, he would want to change a lot of stuff.
I've thought this myself. I think you're right. I think that at the time when that book, when the original autobiography came out, I think it was 94, he was only about 9 years removed from Stick. And Bert, if anything else, is a guy who holds a grudge. You know.
Oh, yeah. He's a bitter man. Very bitter man.
And, you know, remove an additional 20 years from that for the next book, and you know, maybe he was okay with talking about it then.
You said Bert holds a grudge, John. What gives you that? What makes you say that?
This is the one actor who seems to have punched out more of his directors than any other actor that's ever been in the business.
Okay. I know.
Including George Raft, who was a gangster and apparently was easier to work with than Bert. You
know? Okay, so because the thing about Bert is, I know he punched out Paul Thomas Anderson. Who else did he punch out?
He punched out Dick Richards, the final director on Heat.
Okay. Anybody else?
And I think he's punched out another director that I'm just not recalling. He's probably punched out himself.
Do you think? I hope he punched out Alexander Payne. I hate Citizen Ruth.
Oh, I hope so too.
The movie sucks.
He threatened. He didn't punch him, but he threatened. What's his face? Who directed Rocky? John Appleton on WW and the Dixie Dance Kings.
Oh, interesting.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, he threatened him real bad. Like, he grabbed him by the collar and told him not to ever, you know, do this or that.
Do you know who he didn't punch out? Hal Needham.
Yeah, you're right. He did take back, I don't know what the truth is, though, in his latest autobiography, he did take back that, or he did walk it back, that he did not punch out Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, but really?
That it had to take, like, two guys to hold him back on set not to do it.
He almost got into a fight with Thomas Jane on that film. Yeah. Very close to fighting him.
So, you know, that's really interesting because Bert is a guy that I think of as not easy to get along with, but he's a guy who always seems to be having fun making his movies. Like, you watch something like Smokey and the Bandit, and you're like, this guy's having a great time, you know?
Yeah. Well, he's loyal to his friends. He's kind of, you know, he's always got Charles Durning, or he's always got work for all his buddies. James Best, I think, is said to be the secret director of Gator, you know, while Bert was, you know, doing the acting. He's very loyal. Jerry Reed and Hal Needham. I mean, he was given that guy work, you know, steadily, even before they made Smokey and the Bandit. Mm-hmm. A lot of the big guys who show up in movies or whatever that Bert beats up are guys he's used several times. So he's very loyal to... You know, he's very loyal to his pals, but apparently not the best coworker, I'm guessing.
Well, he'd get also pretty petty with his pals. Like, if his pals couldn't show up for whatever reason, they were attached to something else, that was it for you. You couldn't work with Bert again.
So he's like Eastwood, because Eastwood supposedly was like that.
Like Eastwood. You're kind of supposed to be at his beck and call. The best obit that I read on Bert when he died, and I read a lot of them, was, of all people, Joe Bob Briggs. I would recommend reading that. He kind of goes into detail about that stuff.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, interesting. I think I read that back in the day, and have to read it again, because I think it was the best.
We give a lot of attention to Clint on this show. You know, people think we don't like Clint because we talk about him so much that we cover his bad movies, too. But
yeah,
I think we need to give Bert, as you know, a lot of coverage too, because it's such an interesting career.
I'm down.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we still don't have an actor with this gravitas, even though a lot of guys admire him, like Mark Wahlberg and, you know, Billy Zane and others. They're huge fans, but nobody's ever come close to that type of presence.
And he, you know, when he turned down a lot of iconic movies too, some of it seems apocryphal, but like he turned down like Star Wars, apparently.
He wasn't the only one. I think a lot of people turned Star Wars.
And everybody was in that audition room, it seemed.
He turned down The Godfather, I believe.
Wow.
He turned down, I know he was one of the names in the running for Rocky, but that was Stallone wanted to play that part. So
I think so. I heard that was all fake. Like Stallone always had that as a writer, director, star, or writer, star deal.
Oh, really?
You know?
Yeah.
Right. Like they put out, oh, they wanted James Caan or Robert Redford. It was all baloney. Like it was always.
You'd be surprised how many uplifting Hollywood stories are a bunch of garbage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I don't believe for a second George Clooney slept in his car. I don't.
No.
No
way.
Give me a break. Oh my god.
Yeah. No way. No way.
Oh man.
Yeah, Vincent Gallo, I think, called that out as fake in one of his Buffalo 66 interviews.
Honestly,
because Clooney was staying at a boyfriend's house.
Exactly.
Well, and here's the thing too, is like when you're a starving artist, what do you do? You're mooching off your friends. You're mooching off girlfriends.
Right.
You're merch.
Couch surfing.
Yeah. Or you're a trust fund baby, or you've got some sort of safety net. It's just one of those things that it's one of those professions where you need to form relationships and, you know, help each other out. It's hard to have a job that you can just drop at any time. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Stallone thing always smelled fishy to me. Like, I understand the 70s was a much different time and it was a much easier time in an industry that's always been difficult to break into. But the idea that this no-name guy is holding his script ransom because he wants to be the star, I just feel like the studios would have told him to take a hike.
Honestly. Yeah, the UA executive actually said in the press a couple of years ago, he said, oh, we made that story up because it sounded like a good underdog story. Yeah. Underdog makes good.
Yeah.
It helped the publicity of the movie.
Right.
Yeah, because it makes it seem like life is imitating art. Now, I think life did imitate art when he made Rocky Balboa.
Yes.
Everyone was laughing at him for trying to do
that,
especially after what a piece of shit Rocky V was.
Yeah.
And he made the best Rocky sequel, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. I agree.
Right. And it's got AJ Benza in it. And
yes.
AJ Benza looks into the camera and says, "Are you subscribed to my Patreon?"
He's if like, only Patreon were around. Where
he was like, I do this for free. But you, okay, this is like, you're going to church, but you're not going to the reception.
They should have had a clip of AJ Benza's character, like doing a podcast from his bathroom of his sister's house or something. That's how he's been doing his show lately.
Yeah, I got my Tascam. By the way, Tascam records exquisite audio. It's very good. I use Tascams a lot. Very good. You know, in recording, if you're doing a solo podcast, a Tascam is a good investment. Just saying. If you're doing it with multiple people, you know, unless you're in the same room, you've got problems. But yeah, Tascam, fantastic. Anyway, so Stick, as far as Burt Tough Guy movies go, where does this rank for you, Eric? Is this towards the top? Is it towards the middle? What do you think are the cream of the crop of the Burt Tough Guy movies? Where does Stick fall in?
That's a really difficult question because so many of these movies are not very good. And Stick being one of them. But top of the top. Okay, I can do that. And it depends on what your definition of tough guy movie is. I think anything with Burt in it would technically be considered tough guy. Almost.
Mystery Alaska and All Dogs Go to Heaven. Tough guy movie.
Well, okay, not those. But like Smokey and the Bandit is something of a tough guy movie.
Yeah,
you know?
it's kind of Burt. I think of it as like kind of Burt the middle America comedy guy, but it is a tough guy movie. He's a hero you want to emulate because he's fun.
Yeah, Deliverance is a tough guy movie, even though he ends up being the wimp halfway through the movie after a lot of posturing. But so if I had to, I'm not even going to include Deliverance because that's actually really good. Okay, so at the top of the top, would be. No particular order. I would take White Lightning, Heat, The Longest Yard, or parts of it.
Ooh, good.
Nice. Navajo Joe.
Mm.
And, oh, Sharky's Machine, of course.
Ah,
that,
very good.
That's kind of, in no particular order, that is the creme de la creme of for me, of Burt's quasi-action stuff.
John, what about you?
Where this ranks or what I consider is better movies.
Do you think this would be Is this a quality Burt Tough Guy movie? In the Burt Tough Guy
No. And I'll have to get into the detail about that because he got the rights to this to do the film, and he had Elmore Leonard write the script and everything. And this was when Elmore Leonard was the hot crime writer of the 80s, and I don't really know why. He'd write these books that were a lot of dialogue and a lot of comedy, and there was a crime, but it's almost like his suspense and his action scenes are kind of half-assed. Like, he doesn't really care about them when you're reading them. But for some reason, he became a big deal in the 80s. I don't know if it's because Miami was becoming this hot city or something. So I realized when watching this, it plays like a sitcom. And I don't think when they made, like when they were making it, they didn't realize that that's how Elmore's novels kind of come off. Like, you're really reading like a sitcom script or something. It's kind of banter back and forth and dialogue that goes on. And I started seeing, like, okay, when I saw this when I was a kid, we saw it opening night. We were so excited. A new Burt Reynolds action movie. The whole family went out to see it with its lovely R rating and everything. By the way, it's such responsible parents.
Punch repeatedly this Cuban maid in the face.
And you know, it's funny, that violent scene had no effect on me back then, because that's how many violent movies I was watching every week. I was just numb to it and didn't even pick up on it. And when I watched it the second time, the other day, I was like, wow, that's rough. You know, that's a pretty tough scene. I don't think you'd see that today. Even from so-called transgressive directors, you just wouldn't see that.
Absolutely.
And it's a casual coldness to the violence you just don't see in movies anymore. And but I remember when Burt was flirting with Candace Bergen. I guess he was with her on the beach or whatever scene it was. Some rednecks in the back, because this is Vicksburg, Mississippi. You hear whatever. He go pull out that stick. I remember it vividly. I always have these weird incidents that I remember very clearly, but never forgot that. But it's like George Segal, his performance in this movie is like really broad, his eyes are big, and he's just, you know, he's making broad body language gestures and stuff. He's doing a shtick. It's just like he's on a sitcom or something.
Feels like he's in Caddyshack or something
that. Yeah, he's like a Neil Simon comedy. Yeah, he does remind me of Rodney Dangerfield in Caddyshack.
Like he's gonna come in and like ruin the country club.
right. He's gonna play Journey on his golf bag or his bag of clubs. But
Mason.
Right. And then there's this banter between Burt and the black butler. That's a typical Leonard trope. It's always the white guy and the black guy. And then they have this dialogue. It's tense. And then they get along. And there's just certain things that Dutch Leonard, as they called him, always did in his crime novels. And it's all up here. And there's references to, originally the novel Stick was really a sequel to one called Swag. It was also called Ryan's Rules. And Stick makes a reference to that novel, the incidents in that novel, and the character's 10 rules, you know, the Jack Ryan or whatever his name was character in that novel in this movie in dialogue. So it's a little weird because it's like, okay, they're referring to a different story, you know, the previous story, how Stick got into prison. So it's a little weird. You know, maybe they should have made Swag first or something, or I don't know, missed opportunity. But there's no, like, I could tell where they did reshoots, and we'll talk about that later, but there's no real big action setups in the original Leonard script. And supposedly when Leonard wrote the script, Burt brought him a case of toupees and said, which rug should I wear? And Elmore said, don't wear any of them, just go bald. The audience will love you, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
You know, they like you. It's like, don't wear the damn thing. And of course, and then Elmore said that he wore like his worst rug. The thing about this film, it's not really an action movie. It's not really a suspense film. It is a crime movie, but it's kind of all over the place, probably because of the reshoots. And there's this reference to a scam, basically a financial scam. And Alex Rocco is brought in and everything. And all of that feels like it was supposed to build up to something bigger. And I feel like it got cut because of the reshoots, or Elmore Leonard couldn't quite translate what comes off good in a novel into a movie, like without it coming off like just some kind of flat thing, flat dialogue thing. It's hard to explain. It's like, okay, I love the Travis McGee novels, or at least the early ones, but they'd make terrible movies because there's always discussion of these crazy financial scams or real estate scams that you cannot put that in a movie without driving the audience nuts. You know what I mean?
It's like, can't. Darker Than Amber is pretty good.
Which one?
Darker Than Amber is pretty
good. Yeah, that one's good. And that one had the dumbest plot of the books.
Yeah, no, the movie's better than the book.
Yeah, the movie is way better, and it translates better. We'll have to do that sometime. We definitely need to review that one. But yeah, it's just like there's things that work in a novel that don't work at all in a film. When you put it in a film, it's flat, it's dull, or, you know, where as it holds the reader's attention better, it's going to hold the popcorn eater, you know?
Yeah, you don't want a bunch of people discussing some scam for a long period of time in a movie. It's just not.
Yeah, and those scenes were terrible in this film. It's just like they really dragged it, and it's like, okay, well, who's the villain? What exactly is going on? What's he trying to do? And I was trying not to think about the novel just to see how it works, but you can't help but think about the book, and it's like, okay, Dutch wrote this stuff thinking it was going to look real good in a movie, and it doesn't. It there's no way to make it good.
Maybe if it's like a Scorsese, cameras constantly moving, almost video-like thing, that's the way to do it.
A more visually dynamic director, which Bird is not. Bird is very much, he directs like Hal Needham, you know.
Right.
It's like setup, stunt, you know, dialogue, the camera's there.
I think Bird's only like impressive movie as a director is Sharky's Machine.
Yeah. It's something went right about that worked out really well.
Yeah. I like certain scenes. I don't like the movie as a whole, but, you know, like Clint, I put up with a lot to watch Bert. So I like the first action sequence of the movie, which is in the Everglades. It looks like there's actually some danger involved there.
I was going to say, when I watched that scene, I was actually yelling like, holy crap, when I was watching it, because it looked like the stuntmen were in legitimate danger. Like, the fire is spreading so fast. It looks terrifying to be there.
It's a scene that you're never going to see in a movie ever again, because that would just be CGI today.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, so that's a pretty exciting scene. I like, not an action scene, but I like the scene that he first meets George Segal. I'm sorry, Segal. Is it Segal or Siegel?
We always said Siegel, because the ads always said that for the Neil Simon movies. So. George Segal! Yeah.
Have you seen Roller Coaster?
Yeah, I saw it years ago.
He's really good the movie's good. I don't know if he's good. I think he is. I like him in that.
He's a good actor. He's actually a really good actor. He just gives a kind of off-tone performance here.
And I think he said he had a lot of fun making this movie, and he said if you had asked him if I would do a Burt Reynolds movie, I would have said hell no. And he goes, but I ended up doing this film, and I loved it, and I love Burt. Like, I think he had a good time making this film.
The scene that he has with Siegel when he... If Siegel left his keys in his car or something, he asked Bert to get him out of the park. And Bert just is a car thief, so it's a great scene. That's a really good scene. I like that scene. I like seeing what little there is of Miami in the movie. It's mostly Fort Lauderdale posing as Miami. I like to see the city I was, you know, grew up and raised in. It's a city that hasn't been photographed all that much in movies.
And also, Eric, did you appreciate that Bert not only promotes Florida, but he also openly despises New Yorkers in this movie?
Yeah, I'm down with that. It's usually the reverse. I hate it. Even I remember going to see Home Alone in a theater. I don't know how much you remember Home Alone, but the family goes to Florida.
Eric, do you know how many times I've seen Home Alone? Like, well, I don't know how many times I've seen Home Alone.
And you would know. Then you would know that Florida is treated like a trash, swampy, constantly raining sort of garbage hole. Which is taken, you know, the popular consciousness over the past few years. It used to be Jersey. Jersey used to be the punching bag of the country. Now Florida, for some reason, has taken that mantle. But, I mean, honestly, I don't know why you wouldn't want to live in Florida. It's clean, less taxes, more freedom. I don't know what to tell you. But anyways.
Oh, it's the freest place in the world right now.
Yeah, probably.
It really is.
One of them. Like, it is, like, it's freer than Texas.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, Texas is pretty dang free, and Florida's got us beat, and it's had us beat, you know.
Yeah, no, Florida's great. I don't get it. And the more Angelinos I talk to out here, they've never been anywhere outside of California. If they have, it's Europe, of course. And they'll just talk massive amounts of shit of Florida. And it's just like, have you been there? No. And I'm like, all right, well, then I don't know what you're talking about. Look, you guys are complaining about all this shit about a state you've never been to. Like, well, look right behind you. You're going to see a homeless man taking a shit in the street. I'll probably get stick on Blu-ray just because of those scenes I mentioned and because it. But, yeah, is it a good movie? No, it's not. It's glacially paced in places where it shouldn't be. And John actually described it really well. It does feel like a sitcom. Except for the scenes where a Cuban maid is being punched in the face repeatedly.
Dar Robinson falls off of a balcony and in a pretty great stunt.
That's a great stunt, yeah.
So when you don't like this movie because it's paced, it's got a sitcom-y feeling, the pacing's not great. Because for me, the parts that where I was, you know, my eyes were glazing over. Anything with Stick and Candace Bergen, with Bert and Candace Bergen, I was completely not interested in.
Bergen has no charisma. Then they don't have any chemistry.
No.
He rarely has chemistry with his leading ladies. And, Bergman shows up halfway through the movie. I'm supposed to care about her. Did anybody else notice the scene where she's in bed? And I believe it's the monologue about what you just mentioned earlier, swag. It's describing the book, like how he got into prison and how he got out. And did you notice that he had a massive lisp?
No.
I was listening to it. And I was like, oh my god, this is how embarrassing, especially with the AIDS rumors going on.
Jokes.
Oof. 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 No, I didn't.
Bert became
notice that.
Lyle the effeminate heterosexual in the SNL sketches.
You know, the things with that relationship was, you know, she shows up, she's this girl who's competent and powerful, and Bert just, his character just swoops in on her like it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to have a relationship. Like, he'll just walk up and stare at her and be like, hey. Most women would be super creeped out if you acted like that, even if you are Bert Reynolds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just that's everything Bert about Reynolds. Their relationship was completely unbelievable to me.
He's the chauffeur.
Yeah, I was like, he's this rich guy's driver, and he's over here trying to like mac on this powerful, financial person that she is. I was going, why? I'm amazed that she would even look at him. You know,
and she knows the score. That these are all like ex-cons.
Yeah, you know, and
which is a good. I like that. I like this rich loser wanting to be near danger like that. It's kind of a good.
That's a cool thing. I mean, he kind of seems like one of these degenerate rich people like Epstein or something, where he's kind of got this criminal element to him, even though he's not as despicable as Epstein. But you know what I mean? Like one of these rich guys who's got to be around like unsavory types. And although
like Oliver Stone, apparently.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I hate to say it, but Bert should have played the role funnier. At least you could have bought into the charm that he's charming her or something. Like, he should have played it like... I watched the movie Rough Cut. I actually bought the Laserdisc off eBay. You can't... It's never been released on DVD anywhere in the world. And in that movie, he gives the performance that he probably should have given here, where he's very funny and witty, and he's trying to be Cary Grant. And I think that might have worked. And then when a tense situation comes up, he goes into tough guy mode or something, almost like a Mr. Hyde or something. Well, but that would have been more interesting than what he does here, where he's just trying to play it cool and tough all the time.
Something that was weird about Stick was, you know, Bert's character's kind of, you know, he's out of prison and then he's immediately like attacking people and beating him up, and he's with his friend and he's like escalating situations. I was like, this is not somebody I would want to hang out with. Like, he seems
exactly
like,
he's going right back. He's gonna get railroaded right back to prison.
Yeah.
Oh I do like that scene where the guy whose job he took, that guy comes back to the party.
Cecil
that's a
Cecil.
Good scene.
and he totally outwits him without raising his fist.
Right. Yeah, that's good. That's also in the book. I remember that in the book. I remember when I first saw it, I believe it was on YouTube, and I must have seen a different cut because like Sharky's Machine, which ends with Henry Silva falling to his death and immediately, abruptly cuts to credits, it ended the same exact way here, where the albino falls off the balcony and then it immediately cuts to credits. But the version on YouTube has that extended ending where he goes after Nestor, the Santeria witchcraft criminal boss guy. And really, it seemed kind of pointless because it's like, why is he going after Nestor? His beef wasn't with Nestor, it was with Chucky.
Right, because that was the reshoot. That was the additional shooting done that delayed the filming by a year because the Universal executives didn't think it had enough action. And so he shot this entire stuff with that gangster just to set up the big action scene at the end. Because I remember when I saw it in theaters, that was the ending where he went in and did that stupid thing where he knocks out a guy with a gun and tosses the gun aside. So some sort of weird thing there.
That's where my confusion comes from, because it's like, what version did I see on YouTube? Like 10
Yeah, what I saw in a theater had that ending where he went after that gangster and there was the whole thing. And the funny thing is, when I saw it on cable, when I watched it on YouTube, I totally forgot that was the ending, because it was so inconsequential to the rest of the film. For some reason, I was thinking the ending was Dar Robinson falling off the balcony. And it wasn't. It was this additional stuff that just has them going after. Apparently, it costs like $3 million to do those reshoots too, and it's just this big action scene. It isn't terribly logical. It's, you know, Stig suddenly becomes Chuck Norris or something, just taking guys out and everything.
Well, they're sprinkled throughout, I think, because his weight fluctuates throughout the whole movie. It seems like the scene with his daughter, where he's at a park talking to her. I'm almost certain when I was watching, I was like, that's not South Florida, that's Los Angeles. And I looked it up, and apparently there was a filming location in Marina Del Rey, which is in south of Santa Monica.
Right.
So that might have been where that was.
Well, what I had read was originally there were scenes with his ex-wife, played by Tammy Wynette. And they were not used in the film because he did reshoots, and so the ex-wife is never seen. Just like on the early posters, Annie Potts is on the poster. So she had a role in the original cut that's completely lost by the time they did the reshoots.
Who would she have been? His daughter?
I don't think so. She wasn't that young back then, I don't think.
Maybe 52? No, she wasn't. She might have been the Candace Bergen role.
I don't even know if it was that. I think it was like she must have been some character, like maybe a secretary, or maybe she might have been the girl at the bar. I don't know. It's weird. But
the Tammy Wynette choice was Bert's choice because he liked to.
He had dated her, and he. This thing about constantly hiring his old girlfriends. Like Deanna Lund is apparently in this film. I noticed in the credits, and I'm wondering, did he date her in the '60s? And she was living in Florida, and he just called her up to do a small role. Because that's what it seems like. Because he always did that. He'd always hire his old girlfriends for roles or parts. Or, you know, Adrienne Barbeau is in Cannonball Run, and apparently she was pretty bitter about their breakup. And but she's in a movie with him.
And yet she dated John Carpenter.
Married him.
Oh yeah, that's right. She married him.
Had a kid with him.
Yeah.
Talk about a downgrade.
Oh man. Well, maybe John wasn't gay.
Listen. Listen, John's a great director, but as far as men goes, he's no Burt Reynolds. Let's put it that way.
He's looked like a corpse his entire life.
I know. He's always looked like 50 years older than he is.
There was no way he was not going to be a horror director.
In fact, with John Carpenter, okay, you could trot out his picture and say, this is why you shouldn't smoke.
Yeah.
If you want to teach kids not to smoke, say, do you want to look like John Carpenter? This guy looked... Pull out a picture of him now and say, this is him at 20.
For those that watch Halloween every year, next time you watch it this coming October, take careful attention to the scene where Michael Myers appears behind the white linen she's doing the laundry, where he's drying out the linen. You're going to see a plume of smoke enter screen. That's John Carpenter smoking.
Yes. John Carpenter is so addicted to nicotine, he couldn't put the smokes away for one shot. You see his smoke I know exactly the shot you're talking about. I can see it in my head right now. Because every time I watch it, I see John Carpenter's cigarette smoke. Because he can't put the cigarettes away for 5 seconds for this shot.
Halloween was not meant to be the phenomena that it is. It was never made with that intention. And
he's shooting it in scope. You know, he's like, I'm John Carpenter. I'm this great director. Yeah, I know.
He just gave it this great look or whatever. But it was like, Southern Road to Road told me, he said that after it got all these critical raves, you know, its second time around, because first time around, nobody liked it.
Oh, yeah.
He said that suddenly Carpenter was doing these interviews and taking photos wearing the black turtleneck sweater and looking like an intellectual.
It's amazing how quickly people believe their own hype, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's like Carpenter knew exactly how he wanted to look when he was photographed and everything. So, you know.
Exactly. But yeah.
By the way, never do a Halloween episode because it's probably the most overcovered.
Oh no! Yeah,
don't talk about Halloween. You know, just go watch the movie; you'll be fine.
I'm gonna get rid of my DVD of it eventually.
I think we should do the David Gordon Green Halloween. What do you
think? Oh God, I'm not.
That was really bad.
God, it was. That made the Rob Zombie movies more respectable.
I would rather watch Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. Than most the Halloween
sequels. Yeah,
Halloween
2 is a better movie. Rob Zombie Halloween 2 is way better.
Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, it has a lot of problems, but it is so freaking weird and out there that I would rather watch it than most Halloween movies because it's just so bonkers, cuckoo bananas.
I like it when the studios give people like carte blanche to do what they want because it usually ends up being a complete disaster. So I want to see it.
Yeah, you should. It has a lot of stupid stuff like like, you know, teenage girls who love the MC5 and stuff like that. But it is just so out there. It is so unlike any Halloween movie. And it is pure Rob Zombie fever nonsense. It's the best movie Rob Zombie's made by far.
What's strange is that new one, the new Halloween, the what's his name? Gordon Green? David Gordon Green,
yeah.
It seems to be a lot more influenced by the Rob Zombie movies than the original film.
It's also influenced by another one, H2O, another one that hit the reset button, you know.
If it was influenced by Stick, because it was heavily reshot.
Yeah. Well, before we go back
I think Zolly said the whole thing was refilmed.
Oh, it could be.
He said they actually shot it twice. I mean, that's what Zolly claims, so he might be right.
But we've gotten two reboots where Laurie Strode is like a girl boss in both of them. You know,
right?
There's nothing fresh about. It was kind of fresh, I guess. You know, they're doing the James Cameron bit in H2O, but in this one, it was just like, okay, but now she's old and she's a girl boss. Okay. You know.
Yeah, she's like Cleopatra Jones in these reboots or something.
Yeah, I don't remember Cleopatra Jones hiding out in some, you know, death, doomsday scenario. That's ridiculous.
She's got a Wes Craven trap house thing going on.
She treats Michael Myers like some sort of apocalyptic, you know.
Yeah, it's like she's waiting for like she's like Alex Jones or something, waiting for the FEMA camps, but it's Michael Myers. You know,
yeah, it's just
because they rebooted the continuity. He only killed like 3 or 4 people that night. So he's just a guy with some steak knives that
it's a
killed
dude
some people.
In a mask, and then by the time that film takes place, he's 60, 70 years old. Like, come on, give me a break. He's not a threat.
I know.
So, but you said Stick was heavily reshot. What's the story there?
Movie didn't have enough action. Or Universal wanted an action-packed film because they thought they were getting another Sharky's Machine because Sharky's Machine had been a hit for Warner Brothers. So they were like...
The problem, John, is someone leaned on Sharky's Machine, and that's why this movie doesn't...
Right. But Sharky's Machine, the book was really violent and loaded with action, so... and a lot of bedroom action. And, so it was easy to make a pretty solid action film out of Sharky's Machine. Actually by toning it down a bit. And Stick, the novel does not have a lot of violent confrontation. It's not a ton of it. Elmer Leonard does not write action novels. He doesn't write, you know, action crime novels at all. He's not interested in it. When you read it, he doesn't care about that type of stuff. It's like, okay, shoots the guy and that's it, you know. So what Burt did was he went back and I guess he had Joe Stinson write in some action stuff, and Joe Stinson was Eastwood's Dirty Harry scribe or script doctor, And he came in and wrote that all that stuff, I think, with extra scenes of Stick confronting hitmen and confronting the gangster at the end, so they could get some action in there and have some stunt work to sell, you know, put in the trailer and sell the movie on the action aspect. And it kind of just, it derails the film, but it delayed the release of the movie by a year.
Wow.
Yeah, because I remember hearing about Stick in, I think, 82, that he was filming it in 82 or something, and it was supposed to be out in 83, and it came out in 84. And had it come out in...
I thought it came out in 85.
No, it came out in 85. It was supposed to come out in 84, I think spring of 84. And because the posters were up for a long time. And so it came out in 85. And the problem is, had it come out in 84, it would have been ahead of the curve because it would have shown, you know, what little of Miami it has. But it would have been like a Miami thing before Miami Vice was on the air. So by the time it came out, we'd had a year of Miami Vice or two seasons of Miami, or actually a season of Miami Vice from fall to spring, kind of giving us this visual representation of Miami as a, you know, a crime city or whatever for a crime drama. So Stick comes out looking really okay. It's set in Miami, but it's very visually flat and, you know, compared to an average episode of Miami Vice. And it's edited sluggishly. And, you know, even with the additional action, which just kind of throws the movie off tonally, it it really hurt it. And of course, you lost like Tammy Wynette's role. You obviously had reshot stuff with the daughter. I don't know who Annie Potts played. I don't think I found a credit for that anywhere. So it's just kind of like, it's, I don't know if it would have been better if they just released it as was a year before, or better for the film. Who knows? Maybe Burt would have gotten critical acclaim. I don't think it would have been a box office hit. I don't think he has any chemistry with Candace Bergen at all. So I don't, it's hard to explain, but it was a box office dud from what I recall. Like it had a decent opening and just went nowhere after a week.
Burt was still a big star when this came out, but you know,
nah, Stroker Ace, I think came out before this, I think.
Oh, oof. Okay.
Stroker Ace and Cannonball Run 2. And it was kind of a sign that Burt was done.
Cause in the '70s, you know, it's safe to say he was the biggest movie star in the world, right? But
yeah,
by the time we get into the, okay, yeah, I'm looking at, you know, Stroker Ace.
This was his first movie post fallout with the audience.
Yeah, and it did not have what you needed to win.
So like he had Cannonball Run, Sharky's Machine, Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, but then you got Stroker Ace, Cannonball Run 2, City Heat. City Heat is not good. That's one of those movies.
City Heat was a dud too. It flopped.
That's a movie that you would think would be great, but it's
terrible.
Total disaster.
Never finished.
And then right after that, you got Stick. You know, and when you look at the stuff he's doing after that, there's nothing big. You know, you get what? All Dogs Go to Heaven.
You got Malone, which was not big release. I think it was like a flea pit. It had a Flea Pit action track.
How is that movie? I've always been
terrible.
Malone is
terrible.
Awful.
Oh,
it has a post hipster ironic liking now, but it's an awful film.
That's too bad.
Heat. I would recommend Heat. It's flawed.
Yeah.
I watched Heat way back in the day because John recommended it before he was on the show, on that show that he used to be on that doesn't exist.
Yeah, that old show. Yeah. It's gone.
I remember going Heat, not the Michael Mann Heat, but the Burt Reynolds Heat, and I picked it up on DVD. I've still got it.
I like the Burt Reynolds Heat better.
Yeah, it is better. Well, the curse with that was that Heat was released by a company that went out of business, I think, almost as soon as they released Heat.
Yeah.
Like it went bankrupt. Like the company, I think it was Cinetel Films, or it was a company like that that just died right after they released Heat, and it barely made a lot of theaters. I mean, it didn't really get around, because I would have tried to, you know, see it somehow.
Sure.
And I remember it was I don't even think it played my state.
I would recommend the book too.
Yeah, the book is good.
The book is better than the film. The book's very good. And the film is exactly like the book. Like I said, there's just an excursion to LA because the whole thing takes place in Vegas. And then there's a character that, I don't want to give that away, but this I will. There's a character, a hitman in the book called Dancer, because of his likeness to Fred Astaire. And Dancer is not in the film at all. And then, of course, when they remade Heat 25, 30-something years later with Jason Statham, it's a wild card. Dancer is also not in the film. But the movie immediately after Heat, actually, I think it's Malone. So the one after that, Rent-A-Cop, has a killer whose name is Dancer.
Yep.
Figure that out. I don't know.
Oh, I'm still waiting for justice for Prancer and Vixen and Cupid.
Well, also there's a subplot in the Heat novel about, I think, like a televangelist or something, or a...
And then there's a character who is not, let's say, how he appears. Again, I won't give that away. That's also not in the film.
And in fact, the funny thing is, I felt like William Goldman's cash in on the popularity of Elmore Leonard.
It's better than any Elmore Leonard novel.
It is. It is totally better than any Elmore Leonard.
There is a parodic. Is that a word? Like a parody? It does have a sort of whimsical tone to it that does seem like it's taking the piss out of a lot of those crime novels from the '80s.
Yeah.
That's what's kind of enjoyable.
It definitely feels like it because, when it was published, like Elmore was the hottest crime novelist at the time, and so that it definitely felt like it was William Goldman. Oh well, this is how I would write an Elmore Leonard novel, and he wrote something better than any of them.
Yeah. Again, Elmore Leonard, I think his westerns are better than his crime. I haven't read his 70s crime stuff, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
High Noon in Detroit is good. Freaky Deaky is really good. I enjoyed Freaky Deaky. I couldn't get through the movie. The movie changed the setting and everything.
There's a movie of Freaky Deaky?
Yeah, there is.
What?
It went straight to video. It's that bad.
Well, it's because it's called Freaky Deaky. That's a terrible name for a film.
But the novel is set in the 80s, like the setting of the book when it was published. But the movie, for some reason, is set in the 70s. Just so they could have Afro wigs, I guess, and bell bottoms. I don't know.
And the poster's got the Johnny Got His Gun piece thing with dynamite in it. So
yeah, but the novel is pretty good. And remember Lethal Weapon 2 had the bomb in the toilet?
Yeah.
Well, that was stolen from Freaky Deaky. They just totally left it. Yeah.
Lethal Weapon, not as good as we remember.
Lethal Weapon 2 is even worse than you remember. Yeah. So
I was so surprised by how bad that movie is.
Lethal Weapon, the first one, sucks. I couldn't believe how much. Like, last Christmas, I told my wife, hey, let's watch Lethal Weapon. It's good. You know, it's got Mel Gibson, Shane Black. It's good. And we watched it, and it was embarrassing. I was humiliated. It was so bad.
I saw it for the first because it was on HBO Max, and I was just like, I gotta watch these movies.
Yeah, I watched it on HBO Max too. Yeah.
And I watched it like back in October, and I was just like, I can't believe how bad this is. It turned me off to watching the other three.
No, I don't. I don't want to watch them. I'm Yeah. No.
No, they were bad enough when they came out. Although we liked Lethal Weapon 2 at the time, but when I rewatched it about 10 years ago, I couldn't stand it.
The only good thing about Lethal Weapon 2 is it gave us the diplomatic immunity meme.
Everybody
falsely believes that dignitaries can do whatever they want. Everybody believes that, I'm a diplomat. That means I can rape and murder people. No, it doesn't. But you saw Lethal Weapon 2, so you did it, and now you're going to prison.
And they use that for various direct-to-video action films. There was even one called Diplomatic Immunity with Billy Drago as the villain.
I think there was some TV show we watched, and there was a guy going Diplomatic Immunity, and I think that's why we ended up watching it, because I went, this is a Lethal Weapon meme. Like, that's not true.
Yeah. Yeah, the 80s were not the golden era of action films for Hollywood. That's a completely fake Gen X meme. It's totally wrong.
No, the silent era was.
Pretty in terms of stunt work, yes.
Yes, because that was before they had insurance and unions and all that.
That's what guys died making these things. Like, they'd fly the plane in the side of a mountain.
That's partially why you can't make a Western anymore, because you can't topple horses over, and you can't, like, there's certain vegetation that you can't like even be near anymore. Like, it's just too micromanaged and strange. The whole point of watching an action movie is getting excited about an action scene. Like, and how do you do that? You gotta, actually have some real danger, like the Everglades scene in Stick.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it feels legit dangerous. I was, that scene was thrilling, I thought.
That was part of the original cut, because I remember a still from that scene of the two hitmen chasing Stick, and they had these particular guns, was printed in a Guns and like an issue of either Guns and Ammo or Soldier of Fortune. This is the type of stuff I read when I was 11. That like in 1983, and I remember seeing that photo of them filming. They had filmed the Everglades action scene in the original cut.
Nice.
And very quick, I am not pro toppling horses over. I'm just saying. Movies were better back then because of stuff like that.
Seems like they could CGI it these days if they had to do it.
But that already is already a bad move, you know. Like that's
yeah,
crap.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm. The Western, it's a 20th century thing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was cinema's greatest subject, and it's a subject that has passed on.
It's like jazz and comic books and old-time radio. It's all 20th century thing. But so even though you may still see these forms still around, you're never going to get that golden age of that stuff ever again.
It's an imitation. And you know what? If you want to see why Westerns were great, read Joe Carducci's The Stone Mail.
Yes, the official Bible of the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, that, I think, really covers what was special about that early time in cinema that created the Western, tough guy movies, all that stuff. It all crystallizes there. Joe Carducci really finds it in a way that no other film scholar has, you know. It's something that can only come from watching Westerns after rehabbing a building every day. And going, watching the Westerns at night and then thinking about it all day the next day when you're working at the building, you know?
Yeah.
doing your labor, you know?
Right. Well, he's, the thing about Carducci's books is, like the pop and rock, rock and pop narcotic. That's the last book you ever have to read about rock music. And The Stone Mail is the last book you ever have to read about, you know, action films.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, he covers the West, but he covers the East, too. And
yeah,
that's something that makes it very interesting was he looks at this phenomenon worldwide. We see it in America, but we see it in the Soviet Union. We see it in Germany. We see it in all these places that he pulls out and examines. And he looks at it in the context of culture, politics. It's very, very good.
Yeah. Totally worth a read.
And I think
it'll take you a while too. You're not going to finish it in a night.
No, it's a very dense read. But I think Bert is a stone male, you know.
Yeah, he is.
Bert was a football player. Bert was a stuntman. Bert was all these things. And a film that I think really kind of encapsulates Bert's career is The Last Movie Star. Have any of you seen this movie?
Yeah.
It's basically Adam Rifkin just writing a love letter to Burt Reynolds. The whole movie it's Burt's swan song, is what it is. Cause he's very old in it and you can tell you can tell it's painful for him to walk. And Adam Rifkin said that's really how he walks, but you know, Burt's basically playing a cipher of himself who was a stuntman and football player and all these things. And you know, Burt just, he comes out of that stone male milieu that Carducci writes about. That John Wayne came out of, that you know, Harry Carey,
Eastwood,
all these people were stone males. Bird is absolutely one of those.
Right. That's probably why he beats up people on the film set. He's really just this redneck college football
player.
He's
Florida man.
Florida.
Yeah.
And like, how do you relate that to working on Hollywood, you know, studio sets and stuff with a director? You know, some effeminate director bullying you around or trying to, you know, you're probably gonna get a knuckle sandwich from Bert.
Bert is the alpha. You know, who are you, Mr. Director?
Yeah.
I played football. I fell off of horses.
Yeah, and he's totally gonna knock out a stuffed shirt like Thomas Jane.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Todd. Yeah. Bert, you know, it almost feels like in Boogie Nights that Bert is making fun of all the stupid directors he's had to work with when he's like, who are you talking to me? I'm a filmmaker. He's just this sleazy porno filmmaker. I'm a filmmaker. I make movies.
Well, the interesting thing is the Bert presence and charisma is totally killed in Stick because he's so ill and can't really give that type of performance he needed to give for the film.
Yeah. It's too bad. That injury, City Heat, is a movie that should be hated, not because it's only because it's a bad movie, but because it totally ruined. I think that movie really killed Bert. I think it helped kill Bert's career.
It totally.
Because of the injury he sustained on the set, it echoed through for years after that.
Well, and it came at a very bad time for him to begin with, too. It was already like on the outs with the audience, and it's just it was really bad timing overall.
Yeah.
So did Clint do it on purpose? Was Clint like,
"No,
let's take him out"?
I think Clint was really, really pals with Bert. Yeah. I think that was a real friendship there, because Sharky's Machine was originally sent to Clint, and then Clint sent it to Bert and said, "I think you'd love to make this because it's in Atlanta and you love that city."
Or maybe. Maybe Clint was like, "I'm gonna ruin Bert's career."
Yeah, well, Clint, like, but you know, the legend with Every Which Way But Loose was originally the script was written for Bert, and the writer wanted it sent to Clint so he would give it to Bert. And Clint read the script and said, "I'm gonna do this myself," and so it changed everything. And that was, I think, to this day, that's still Clint's biggest hit.
It is.
Every Which Loose.
It was at least at the time it was.
And he was accused of making a Burt Reynolds movie even at the time. It said, why is he making a Smokey and the Bandit type of thing?
It would not shock me if that writer was hoping for it to go to Burt, because that does seem like a Burt Reynolds film.
And then Sharky's Machine was sent to Clint, and he's like, you know, I owe Burt one. So, you know, Burt, I think this is perfect for you. And it was. Burt. It was like,
they send me a script and it's good, I take it. But when it sucks, I give it to you. Yeah. So when I get Any Which Way But Loose, it's mine. But when I get Sharky's Machine, I'm going to lean that on you, pal.
But if you think about it, though, like, Sharky's Machine does have a lot of Clint trademarks. It's even got a jazz music score.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
Does it have any love scenes in Carmel, California, in the woods?
No, there's the scene between him and Rachel Ward. But they don't have any chemistry, so it's just really, you know, he should have gone to Carmel and filmed some stuff there.
I don't think Clint had any. He didn't feel threatened by Burton. I don't think vice versa either. They kind of shared the same audience, but what they brought to the screen was totally different.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it is the same audience. I mean, it was almost like, okay, these movies are for the truck drivers and the ham and eggers, you know, the blue collar, the Joe Lunch Bucket types. And it's just Clint got a lot of critical attention in France, I think, in the 90s. And that kind of changed his image.
Yeah.
But critics hated both of them in the 70s. And people see their stuff in droves.
Pauline Kael, you know, they remind me of guys.
Pauline Kael, any wimp that probably saw them as like the jock or in high school they were afraid of or whatever, it's like, it's obvious when you're reading the reviews.
Yeah, when you read reviews, it is very obvious when the reviewer, you know, just sees the leading man as they just project the kid who, I'm not going to say bullied them, because I think that the whole jocks bullying nerds thing is projection. I think they just ignored them.
Yeah, or they didn't get along with them. There was something Adam Carolla said where he said, "I didn't see it as bullies. They were just kids I didn't get along with."
Yeah. We just didn't talk to each other. But then they're like, "Oh, these jocks, they were bullied. I never talked to you."
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, you'd say something in class and I wouldn't react to it because it didn't interest me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's this, it's like, you know, you didn't worship me, therefore I hate you, because I have this inflated sense of my own intellect and ego. And I think I'm so great and I'm so smart. And you didn't recognize it, so I hate you.
Exactly.
And Bert played football. So
was a tough guy.
He must be destroyed. Yeah. He played football.
And in some movies, he plays a somewhat excessive bully. Like in The Longest Yard, I think it opens with him slapping his girlfriend, you know, knocking her across the room and stealing her car.
Does Adam Sandler do that in the remake? I think so.
Does he? I don't know.
I never watched it, so I don't know. I highly doubt that.
Hey, you!
Yeah, he does like a Cajun.
I'm gonna snap you around now.
He does a Cajun man voice and punches her.
Yeah. And
kicks her in the kneecaps or something.
There was a lot of Burt Reynolds gags in Adam Sandler movies, like in Happy Gilmore, the limo, Shooter McGavin's limo drives by and he goes, "Whoa, it must be Burt Reynolds or something." Like, I think
all those guys grew up loving Burt. John Favreau was like a huge Burt Reynolds fan, and you know, all those guys grew up admiring. Was the man.
And Sandler remade Longest Yard and put Burt in it, you know.
Yeah. He was like,
Hey, Mr. Reynolds. Let me ask you something. Mr. Reynolds, you want to be in
who does Burt play in that? The Warden or something?
He plays, I think he's playing like a, I forget. It's been a long time since I've seen it. Let me see here. The Longest Yard, that was
2006, I think.
2006. The Longest Yard, 2005. Yeah, he plays the coach.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That makes sense. All right. Yeah. I think that movie's mostly remembered for Burt slapping somebody on the red carpet.
Adam Sandler didn't slap anybody on the red carpet.
He was asking. It was a journalist. He was asking Burt. Like, I guess he was asking a bunch of inane questions. And Burt said, "Have you seen the original?" And he said, "No." And he just slaps him.
He's like,
"There's there's
what are
footage
you doing?
Of that.
Are you misbehaving there, Burt?" Agent Reynolds, yes,
I'm just doing Adam Sandler character.
The greatest actor that ever worked. We did that. The best ever.
Yeah.
You guys seen WWE in the Dixie Dance Kings?
Yeah,
I've never seen it.
I like it a lot too.
That's actually the second Burt Reynolds movie I saw when I was a kid.
Yeah, I made a mistake. I should have added that on the list. Maybe taken out Navajo Joe. But
you like it because he punched John G. Alvinson, right?
That's the main reason. I don't know. There's something fun and quirky about it. I like it better, and it fits more in line with the Smokey and the Bandit stuff. I like it more than any of those movies.
Yeah, it's set. I think it's set in like the 50s or 60s, and it's kind of like got this vibe because it was filmed in Nashville. And it was actually financed, I think, by the Gaylord Corporation that produced Hee Haw. But they actually made a really good comedy adventure film or whatever you want to call it, comedy musical adventure. It's a lot of fun. Or it's the most underrated movie because he doesn't have a mustache, so nobody remembers it.
Just like Deliverance. Nobody remembers he was in it because he doesn't have a mustache.
Right. But another thing is, like, one movie I like more when I watch it, you know, once every 10 years. I actually like it more now than I did when I was a kid. It was like Seamus.
Mm.
Yeah, Seamus is, I got to rewatch it. It was a pretty average affair with some good highlights, I remember. There's that whole stunt reel moment where he's just in that factory or where is he? He's in some sort of, there's a bunch of plywood everywhere and he's just like sliding around the floor and stuff. It seemed
He does some really cool stunt work in that, and although I think Hal Needham is doubling him in that infamous tree stunt that I think he claimed injured him, but it looks like Hal Needham to me. But there's something about Seamus that I think the Spencer novels of Robert Parker, I always felt, while I realized the last time I watched Seamus, I think Bob Parker saw this movie and started basing his Spencer novels on this film. The way that Burt is like this tough but smart aleck private eye. It's really like the first movie like that, where he's like a brawler, but he's also a total smartass trying to be funny all the time.
I'm sorry, you're saying that he, the post-Parker novels after?
Well, the Spencer novels, not...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Talking about Spencer, not the Richard Stark.
I got confused for a second. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, but I totally think that influenced Robert B. Parker's Spencer novels, which Mark Wahlberg just fucked up with some Netflix movie, which is completely unfaithful to apparently a book written by the writer who continued after Robert Parker's death and was writing Spencer novels. They basically did one that apparently did a Netflix movie. It's just completely unwatchable by anybody who's read those books, which aren't okay. I'm not saying the Spencer novels are great, but when I was a kid, they're a lot of fun. And I think if you're going to do a movie, you might as well be faithful to that style. But Seamus is more like a Spencer novel than, you know, like the Spencer TV show or the Mark Wahlberg movie. Well,
the reason it's bad with Wahlberg is because when Mark Wahlberg isn't being directed, he delivers every line like he's asking a question.
Right, right. It's probably like that. But like Seamus, I think, is a really fun movie. I mean, Seamus you could pick up cheap, I think, on a lot of different DVD packages. I think that's really a fun prime Burt movie.
Yeah, I scored when I got it at Walmart. That comes with four movies, Anderson Tapes being another one. I don't remember what the other two are.
It was Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and
I got it on a set from Mill Creek with that includes Physical Evidence and Switching Channels.
That's the one. That's yeah.
Yeah, I still haven't watched it. So
the Sean Connery heist movie?
No, Anderson Tapes is not on there.
Oh, then maybe it's not it then. No. But Physical Evidence is one of the other movies I remember now, which is okay.
Oh, The Man Who Loved Women is the third film on there.
Yeah, not that.
The Man Who Loved Women.
A terrible Blake Edwards film that also, I think, flopped and turned the audience against Burt.
Well, you know, Blake Edwards was fired on City Heat, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. I think they worked on Man Who Loved Women, and then he was supposed to do City Heat with Burt and Clint, and Clint and Blake Edwards did not get along at all, and, you know, hey, clash of egos.
This guy's not funny. Let's get it.
Yeah, Burt described it in the in his first biography as Blake Edwards was a caviar and champagne man, and my friend Clint was a pretzels and beer guy. So
yeah, not a good. There's some pairings that, you know, we as fans will go, well, that doesn't work. But at the time, you know, when you're in show business, you know, you may not. May think, I am Blake Edwards. He does good movies. Hey, Clint, we like Clint. Let's do it together.
Yeah, now hindsight's 2020.
Yeah,
Clint and Burt should have done like a redneck action comedy. They shouldn't have done this 30s crime tribute. So.
They should have done something like Dion Brothers.
Yeah, exactly. Or 48 Hours, something like that, you know, with the original plot where it's supposed to be a Cajun and a cop in New Orleans.
I feel like we've mostly talked about Burt in general. This is like just a Burt Reynolds episode.
You know, we haven't done a Burt show, I don't think.
Yeah, I think every time we've tried to do like Sharky's Machine or something, it's just fallen off.
We mourned him after his death.
No, we did. One of our most infamous episodes was Cannonball Run 2.
Oh, that's right.
I wasn't on
that one. You were not here for that.
No,
that
I was
notorious
not.
Episode.
Thank goodness. Dodge that.
It sealed our reputation as the podcast you don't want to listen to.
Yeah. Cannonball Run 2 show. I was fortunate I missed that one. And I was fortunate I missed having the director of Hebrew Hammer on, because that guy came on the show ready to attack me personally. Like, he came on out for my blood, and y'all were like, he's not here. It neutralized him completely, you know. So
was he coming after you?
Because I wrote for Breitbart, and he was like, he found out that the show he was going on, there was a guy who wrote for Breitbart on the show, and he was ready to stick his forks into me. He was ready to attack. He was back for the attack.
Yeah.
But fortunately, you know,
even though Hunter will be the first to tell you, don't ever write for Breitbart.
No, yeah, don't write for Breitbart. It's a total scam. You know. That site's a complete scam, just like the Huffington Post and everything. Writing for them I'm not going to say it was a mistake, because I made connections there that really did help me. I think the first interactions we had were on Breitbart.
Yeah, I think I was correcting you, your
corrected
articles.
Something stupid I said, you know, so I think that's where we first connected, but, you know, it was really because of the other podcast, but, you know, and
I
made the connection. I was like, I think this is the guy who was correcting me on that. but you know, I think the culture there kind of, you know, we made connections through it that, you know, I think are invaluable, and I'm not going to say it was a mistake, but if you have the opportunity to write for a website like that, don't.
Yeah. Well, that was also the early days.
Yeah. When I was writing for it, they actually had legit celebrities writing for it. You know.
Yeah.
Bob Gale. You know, there were really good writers like Leo Grimm.
The guy who wrote 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that guy. He wrote for him.
Like, I remember, like, Kirk Cameron was writing columns like
Mike Barron wrote for him. Michael Moriarty was writing for
Michael
him.
Michael Moriarty, that's right. Yeah. James Woods, Robert Davi. You know?
Yep.
So when I was writing for them, you know, I was sharing the page with some pretty big names, so that was cool. But any site that pays you an exposure, just don't. You know, it's a bad gig, and it devalues writing. These days, I would say don't do it. But it was not a mistake. I'm glad I did it.
You know, Robert Davi's a a crooner now.
Yeah, he is. Didn't he made a movie about it with Peter Bogdanovich or something?
It doesn't surprise me. He's really, I didn't know that about it, but it wouldn't surprise me. He's pretty passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
He sang opera on an episode of Wise Guy, so I think he's got a good singing voice.
Yeah.
Stick. I get the feeling you guys really hated it.
No, I think you might be surprised by my review.
Okay, well, give me your review, Eric. Let's hear it.
I'll get a 5.5.
The
slightly above average, only because of the scenes that I like. I think the scenes that I like are pretty strong.
John, what about you?
I give it a 4.5.
Okay.
And it's just because it's tonally all over the place. This time while watching it, because I'm older, I spotted the reshoots right away, and they totally throw the movie off. And, you know, I absolutely hate any scene where the hero knocks out a hitman who's there to kill him, grabs a gun, there's another hitman around, and he just tosses the gun in the garbage.
Yeah.
And also, it commits the ultimate gun faux pas, which is the suppressor on a revolver.
Oh yeah,
which doesn't work.
Well, and you know, he has this showdown with the albino hitman. He totally defeats him, but he doesn't kill him. And the guy comes back later, and you know is shooting at the place. And I was going, really?
The guy's trying to kill him. The guy's trying to kill him.
Why are you? What? You know, there was stuff like that. That's just really stupid.
Yeah,
I can't stand that. Said my expectations going into this were nothing. I didn't know anything about this movie. I just knew it was a Burt Reynolds film, and I had a lot of fun with the scenes that were good. The stuff in the Everglades with the explosion was great. Some of the shootouts are fun. Some of the tough guy moments with Burt are really cool, like where he smacks around that loudmouth New York guy. So I think I enjoyed it a little bit more than you guys, but that's because I went in expecting nothing. Like, never seen it, had zero inkling going in, and so, you know, there were times where I totally tuned out, like anything with Candace Bergen. I think I was picking up my phone during those scenes, you know, just I don't care.
She's dead air. She's just
totally
dead air there.
Dead air.
Charlie McCarthy would have been better in the role than her.
You know, and Charles Durning is fun as the sort of tacky bad guy, one of the tacky bad guys. I think this is a very generous rating, but I would give it like a 6.
Okay. Whoa!
I think that's pretty fair,
Mr. Nice Guy here.
Yeah, I because honestly, I had no expectations, and the stuff I enjoyed, I really enjoyed, and the stuff I didn't enjoy, I just kind of tuned out. So, you know,
right?
It had
Charles Durning reminded me of Harry Knowles when I first saw this.
Harry Knowles based his whole image on Chucky and Stick.
He knows dress like him, yeah. But yeah, anything to add before we go, John?
Stick, even though it's not very good, it's not even good. I wish that he made more movies like it. I don't mean quality wise. I wish he made this type of film more instead of the Stroke Races and, you know.
It seems I think this is a function of Burt picking the projects that seem like the most fun rather than the stuff that's good for him. Because I think Burt could have done a lot more tough guy movies like this and it would have been great.
Yeah. There's a surprising small amount of that kind of stuff in his filmography. He seemed to just lean on, like you said, the fun stuff. I'm not sure. I agree with him wanting to do a fun project because I think I'm pretty sure he was aware of his career lagging, so he needed a hit. Mm-hmm. And yes, the comedies were financially sound for him, but it was also a comedy that kind of ruined his career, Stroke Race. So I don't know if he was super into doing something along those lines. You know, with a competent director and just tighter script and tighter instincts, I think we could have had an okay movie. And he should have done more movies like that. He should have done more movies like Heat. Mm-hmm. But sadly, that just wasn't the case.
He had the chance too. He had offerings to do the types of movies that would have helped his.
Yeah. Malone, technically that kind of movie too, but that's also not a good movie.
Right. And that was done for hacks. You know, like the director was Harley Cochlis, who was mostly a second unit guy most of his career. And he was up for doing Mac Bolan, The Executioner, I think, in the late 70s. And he was playing basically a dice game with the studio and just never got around to making it. And then he was going to supposedly direct it, I think, with Stallone starring in the role before the Friedkin project of The Executioner was about to come about. That never happened. But he was offered, I think he was going to do a movie for Golden Harvest, where he and Jackie Chan teamed up. And this would have been in 1988, when that would have been a pretty cutting edge thing. And I think the title was something like Pals, where they were going to play like rival spies who ended up teaming up. And the idea was Burt would direct the film, but Jackie would direct all the action scenes. And that would have been more interesting than, well, what either of them did afterwards. Yeah. So.
I mean, regardless of how those movies would have turned out, say they were terrible or didn't make any money, I'm talking like from a legacy perspective, that would have been better.
Exactly, because they would have shown some ambition or at least a willingness to try to do a different type of action movie or a new type of action film rather than, you know, trying to go back to the Sharky's Machine well with something like Stick and, you know, Malone.
He turned down Die Hard.
Yes, he did.
That's right. Yeah, that was one of the ones he turned down.
And famously threw some shade at Bruce Willis in his autobiography by saying, "I don't regret anything that I turned down that Bruce Willis eventually did."
So you turned down Striking Distance as well?
Oh, boy, Striking Distance. Holy shit.
Well,
That's Bruce's stick right there, Striking Distance.
Yes. Oh God, I remember the Gore Gazette review. Should be called Stroking Distance. You'll have to jerk off to stay awake watching this thing.
Oh, gosh. All right, guys. Anything else to add before we sign off?
I wouldn't say you shouldn't check out Stick, but I think you should watch White Lightning or Sharky's Machine first, or The Longest Yard, or.
Right.
Even Seamus before you watch Stick.
I think this
you might come away with a bad impression.
Yeah, I don't think this is a Burt classic by any stretch, but if you are a Burt fan, you should watch it, is what I would say.
Yeah, watch it once.
Well, that's it. Go visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com. Hit us up on Facebook. We have a great group, so come check it out. With that, I'm going to say adios.
And that's about all. Peace out.
Well, good night.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.